right. There we go. I'm here. Wednesday morning Bible study, Gospel of John. We're going to do the first half of chapter 9 today. First half of chapter 9. So if you remember from chapter 8, which it took us 3 weeks to get through, it's a long chapter. It was the end of the Feast of Tabernacles, and Jesus was in the temple, and he makes a comment, "I am the light of the world," back there early in chapter 8. And the Jews start arguing with him, the Pharisees. You know, how can you give testimony about yourself? Well, my father gives testimony. Well, you are slaves, Jesus accused them. No, we're not slaves. We're sons of Abraham. No, Abraham's not your father. The devil is your father. You remember all of this?
Oh, yeah.
And it escalated. It escalated. And finally, at the very end, I'm going to go down to the very end, and that'll get us into chapter 8. The last two verses of, or chapter 9, the last two verses of chapter 8, Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." And that's an accurate translation. I am there, that's ego I me, which is the Greek translation of the name Yahweh. Jesus is very clear here, without any ambiguity, he's calling himself God, Yahweh. So, they recognize that, all of this debate and argument that's taken place, the whole chapter. So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. Now we don't presume that this is like some magical, disappearing act. You know, he didn't use an invisibility cloak from Harry Potter, you know, something like that. It's just a case of, you know, they turn to go get some stones and he melts into the crowd. It would have been quite a crowd there for the Feast of Tabernacles, so he just kind of disappears in the crowd. He hid himself, which means they could not see him. All right? The reason I bring that up is because that leads us directly into chapter 9 and the theme of chapter 9. And what is the chapter 9 about? The entire chapter is about one miracle. What does Jesus do?
Blind man.
There it is.
Here's a blood.
Heals a blind man. A blind man who cannot see Jesus, but then comes to see Jesus. Versus the Jews who could see Jesus, but then descend into not seeing Jesus. Do you see how the two cross? It's really ironic how this happens. Okay? So let's get into it. Chapter 9. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" First of all, as he passed by. So Jesus is still in the area. We're going to find out later in this chapter, actually today yet. It mentions the Pool of Siloam. I'm going to show you a map where that is. He's still in Jerusalem. It's the Sabbath day. So I'm going to speculate, and this is just a little bit on my part, that this is 1 or 2 days after the end of the feast. Okay, so the feast ended, Feast of Tabernacles. We know that the last day of the feast was back there when Jesus was arguing with the Jews, because it said it. So as he passed by, a day or two later, he's still around, he saw, there's that word, saw. Okay, we're going to, a lot of that theme in this chapter, seeing and not seeing. Being blind or not being blind. Jesus saw a man blind from birth. Now, why does that matter? And how does he know?
He's God.
He's God.
Well, he's God. Sure. So in that sense, he would know.
Used his divinity? Part of his divinity?
Yeah, he might have. I think there's even a more a plain answer. A man blind from birth. If you had a handicap, can I say handicap or is that not correct? I'm going to say it. All right.
Disability.
Yeah, disability. There we go. If you're blind or you're lame or you're deaf, you can't walk or you can't function somehow, what could you do to support yourself back in that climate? There was really only one thing.
Beg.
So if this man was blind from birth, what's he doing?
Begging.
Probably has a regular spot where he goes. We come to find out later in the chapter that his parents are still around, so maybe he is still living with his parents. That's very likely. Because if you had a disability, then you really only had two options. You either just live with family or relatives and they just take care of you, or you go out and beg. And people generally would help support beggars. So you would see this beggar day in and day out at the same spot. You get to know who he is. Okay, he's been blind from birth. I know his parents or I know his relatives. So it would be common knowledge. So Jesus maybe knew him, had already seen him, or heard from others who've seen him. Yeah, this guy's been here for his whole life. He's been blind from birth. Now, why does it matter that John records for us that he was blind from birth? That matters also. This was not a temporary issue. This isn't a case where somebody, like in our modern understanding of things, could say, well, he might have had an infection that caused him to be blind, and the infection got cleared up at the moment Jesus supposedly healed him, so it wasn't really a miracle.
Oh, okay.
No, it's a miracle. This guy is blind from birth. He couldn't see a thing, and it was known throughout the community that he was blind from birth. And then he ends up being healed, cured of that seeing, so we know that, okay? And his disciples asked, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents? Now, how do the disciples address Jesus?
Rabbi.
And what does rabbi mean?
Teacher.
Teacher. Very respectful, very formal, but not near enough, is it?
Well, no.
Is Jesus a rabbi and a teacher?
Yeah.
Yes, but he's more than that, right? Remember what the whole theme of the Gospel of John is?
Jesus.
Who is Jesus? What is the identity of Jesus? Who is he? Well, here, yeah, he's the Christ, right? Here, the disciples, they think he's the Messiah, but they still don't know what that means. They won't know until after the resurrection, Pentecost, really. So they call him teacher. So again, that's an identity cue of who Jesus is. He is that, but he's so much more than that. And they ask this question, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now that was a common understanding back then, and it still is today. I have had people come to me, Pastor, what did I do that God is punishing me for? Why do I have this problem in my life, or these problems, or this constant issue? Why is God punishing me? What did I do? What sin did I commit? Does God punish you for sins that you commit? Does God ever punish you for a sin that you commit?
He forgives.
He forgives. You, being people of faith, this might not be true of people who are not of faith, who are not children of God, you, being children of God, are never punished for a sin that you commit by God. Ever. God put all of that punishment where?
Jesus.
Right there on Jesus. Now, sins that we commit may have earthly consequences. You do something stupid and you injure yourself. Yeah, there's a punishment. Why is there some giggling back there all of a sudden?
We're looking at Bob.
Yeah,
everyone's looking at me.
Looking at Bob?
Yeah. It's my clumsiness.
There you go, your clumsiness. We can do something sinful, or someone around us can do something sinful, and there are earthly consequences for that. But it's not a punishment from God. Eternally speaking, God does not punish you for anything, nor does he punish you in an earthly sense either. Those earthly consequences are just that. Earthly consequences of our stupid sinfulness, or those the sinfulness of those around us. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's not God punishing you. Okay, so that's never the case. But people back then, as well as today, still think it is. Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? After all, blindness is a problem of sin. Well, on the one hand, that's true. So somebody must have sinned, either this man or his parents. Well, if this man was blind since birth, when would he have sinned?
In the womb?
Now, we do know from King David in Psalm 51 that we're sinful from the moment of conception. But that really wouldn't result in somebody being blind because we're all sinful from the moment of conception. So maybe it was his parents that sinned, because if his parents sinned, then, the disciples are thinking, God must be punishing the parents by giving them this extra burden of a blind child. Is it an extra burden? I don't like using that term because I don't think handicapped children are a burden. So there I'm being a little bit politically correct, but I think in a Christian sense, because we should never see people who have disabilities as being a burden. They're still a gift from God, right? So there's a little soapbox moment for me. But the thought is, well, the parents have this blind child, so they must have sinned. Was there a hand back here, Ellen?
Just a few weeks ago, I saw a rerun of Touched by an Angel. And sometimes it's kind of, but this one was really interesting because they, when she was a teenager, wasn't on my mother. She had a child that was handicapped. And her parents told her her whole life that that was God's punishment. And when she met with the angel at the end, they said, God didn't punish you by giving you that child. He blessed you.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a great answer.
That's actually sound theology. So that's amazing to be on a TV show. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a blessing. It's a blessing. Not a punishment. So, they're asking the wrong question. This is an invalid question, right? But that was common thinking back then. Who sinned, this man or his parents? Jesus answered, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. Why do sometimes things happen that we would perceive as punishment or challenges or difficulties in life? Why does God allow some of those to come through? He doesn't create them, the problems in life. And in fact, my first answer when somebody says, why is God punishing me this way? And I say, God is not punishing you. Well, can't God take away my problem? Yes, he can take away your problem, and you've heard me say this. He takes away most of your problems. You just don't know it because they never appear to you. But why does God allow a few problems to sneak through in our lives? For various reasons. But that's not for punishment. It's for the glory of God. Why does God allow some difficulties in our life, some challenges and problems? I'm going to rattle off a few reasons. We don't know why for specific ones, but you've heard me say this before. He might allow problems in your life to strengthen you. Strengthen you in faith. It causes you to go back to him in prayer. He might cause problems in your life in order for you to be a witness to someone else who's got problems in their life. He might cause problems in your life so that you are aware that he is there helping you and watching over you to give you aid and strength. There's other reasons that I've come up with in the past. There's a number of reasons why God allows difficulties in our life. And we perceive them as difficulties. God perceives them as methods of strengthening us or helping us or directing us in a certain direction. There's another reason why. Sometimes God might allow something that we perceive as a problem in order to move us in a certain direction in life. Say, no, don't go that way, go this way instead. And so he puts a roadblock there. Okay, that's another reason. Janet?
I have to say that many times too, if a person might have a disability in one area, there's a chance that God gave them an extra ability in another.
Sure.
And many times, we don't realize that, right?
Sure. God could be giving you difficulties in life to refocus you on other areas where you're stronger. Yeah, very possible. So there's a number of reasons, and I could probably, if I thought about it, rattle off some more. We don't always know the reason. Sometimes we do. But God allows some bad things in life so that the works of God might be displayed for the glory of God. Remember Mary and Martha and Lazarus dying? Jesus, why weren't you here? I wasn't here because this is for the glory of God. Jesus said the same thing. All right. And then he says, verse 4, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. See that? I am the light of the world. That reiterates what he said a day or two prior at the end of the feast. Caused a big argument with the Jews. But here he says, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Here's the question. Who is we? And what does Jesus mean by day and night? Day and night. Keep in mind, this whole miracle is about seeing and not seeing. In daytime you can see, in night you cannot. So who is this referring to? Well, I'm going to give you three answers. And they don't come from me, they come from Dr. Weinrich in the commentary that I read. So I will point that out just to give him credit. So the most obvious thing Jesus is referring to when he says, we must work the works of him who sent me. Who is it that sent Jesus?
God.
God the Father sent Jesus, and he sent Jesus for a specific purpose. What was that purpose?
To redeem mankind,
die on the cross, give us forgiveness of sins. And along the way, what does Jesus do? Multiple works, teaching, miracles, healing people, casting out demons, all sorts of stuff. So the most obvious understanding of this verse, we refers to Jesus and his disciples. Day refers to the period of time when Jesus walked this earth. While he is here with his disciples, we must do the work of God, the ministry of God. Night is the time when Jesus is gone from this earth. He's ascended into heaven. Okay? That's explanation number one. Explanation number two on this is that day and night is referring to us. We means all of us, God's extended disciples, God's people. We must do the works of him who sent Jesus, so the ministry among each other, and we must do that while it is day. When is day? When you are alive. When is night? When you're sleeping in the grave waiting for judgment day to arrive. Okay? So while you are alive on this earth as a child of God, you are part of that we, and we are to do the ministry that God puts before us, that God sent Jesus to do. Does that make sense? Okay. Third thing that this could mean is we, in the broader sense, we, meaning all of us, must do the work of God who sent Jesus while it is day, day meaning among those people who are spiritually open, who are inquisitive, who want to know more about God or about Jesus. Talk to them. Tell them about it. Night is are those people who are hard-hearted and closed-minded about God and don't want to hear it. So, do the ministry of God among those people who are willing to receive it. Because night is coming. Is night on the horizon for us right now?
Sure.
There are more and more people, sadly, who are closed-minded about God and hard-hearted about religion and don't want to hear about any of it. Right?
Yeah.
Is night coming?
Oh, yeah.
Night is coming. So there's three interpretations of this. Which one is correct?
Yes.
Yeah, all of them. Yeah, right. Exactly. Bob?
Now, Jesus is saying this, and when he says we, is not he including himself in our humanity?
Yes. Yes, right. He's including himself with us. Frankly, he's including us with him.
Well,
yeah.
He's including us with his we.
Yes. Correct. Correct. Very good. All right. Let me move on a little bit. Verse 6. Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. First of all, has the blind man said anything yet?
No.
Did he ask Jesus for mercy?
No.
Did he ask to be healed?
No.
Who takes the initiative?
Jesus
does. Does he take the initiative with you?
Yes.
Yes. Do we ask to be forgiven first before we're his children, before we're baptized? We don't ask for it. God comes to us first. So that's the first thing to note here. Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Now I want to read for you from the Lutheran Study Bible a footnote here because it's interesting about this verse. So some of you have this. Chapter 9, verse 6, and John spat on the ground and made mud. Jesus violated the rabbinic rules concerning the Sabbath. The rabbis listed kneading dough, among 39 forms of work that is forbidden on the Sabbath. a law thought to cover the mixing of earth and saliva. We're about to find out this is the Sabbath day. So that's the first reason the Pharisees get all upset, because Jesus is breaking the Sabbath rules, because according to their man-made rules, one of the forms of work you could not do on the Sabbath is kneading bread. And making mud out of saliva is in the form of kneading.
Yeah, right.
So therefore, he's breaking the Sabbath rules. You see how picky this is?
Yeah. Yeah.
That is so picky. Back to my joke from a week or two ago about how you tell your kids to do a certain chore and they do exactly what they tell you, we tell them, and only that and no more. Right? It still happens to me. Jill calls them little lawyers.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you know it, right? Further, one more little bit of this footnote in here about this verse. Anointed. In ancient times, saliva was thought to have curative powers, such as how animals clean themselves. You know, cats are always licking themselves.
Yes.
Keep themselves clean, and then, yeah, periodically cough up a hairball.
Yeah. Yes.
While I was talking, I'll give her credit. Jen Steffens was texting on her phone and checking, and she says, actually, saliva, in the modern day sense, saliva has been shown to have some antibacterial properties.
Really?
Keeps your mouth clean from cavities. If you have dry mouth, that causes some dental problems. Mm-hmm. And it does have, in a small sense, some curing powers. And I'm like, I still think that's kind of gross. Were we supposed to lick our wounds? Actually, maybe that's where that phrase came from. You have to go, he has to go off and lick his wounds.
Well,
that's like a little catchphrase. Well, maybe that's where it came from. Yeah. Because you lick your wounds, right? And I'm like, oh. Remember the poor beggar Lazarus who was laid at the rich man's door, that whole story? And he was so poor that the dogs came and licked his wounds.
Yeah.
Same idea, okay? So, would Jesus spit have curative powers?
You bet.
Of course it would. Not just because there's thought that spit in general does, but it's from Jesus. So that's the real truth. It's from Jesus. Okay. Now, a little clarity on a translation issue here. It's not a real big deal in this case. The word here is not mud. The word here is clay. Whoops. Get off of that. The word here is clay, not mud. Now, why would that matter? I think the translators translated it as mud, because if you think of clay in our modern-day sense, we think of hardened pottery. And this would have been soft and pliable, because he would have spit and made a little batch of mud, we would think of, but think of it as like wet clay. Now, why is it important that he's making clay with his saliva?
Adam and Eve were.
Yes, very good. And that's what Dr. Weinrich says in his commentary too. You're in good company, you two who thought of that. Jesus made, God made the entire world by speaking, but how did he make humanity? From clay, the dust of the ground. And then what did humanity do? We corrupted our own clay, these jars of clay, as Paul says elsewhere. So what is Jesus doing? He's restoring this man through clay. See, it's a connection to creation. And that's intentional by the Apostle John pointing that out. That's why I like this word anointed. It doesn't say, and I'm not sure what other translations say, I didn't look it up, but he anointed. He didn't smear the mud on his, the clay on his eyes. He didn't like rub it on. He didn't drip it on. He anointed his eyes. When you think of the word anointed, that's an accurate translation in this case. When you think of the word anointed, what do you think of?
Anointed with oil.
Anointed with oil?
It's a ceremony.
It's a ceremony.
To signify this person is...
the king, or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Good.
It's like when you put the ashes
on. Ashes. Okay, we just had Ash Wednesday. Anointed with ashes. Okay. I hadn't thought of that, but that's true. I think that's a good... what else do you think of with anointed?
Baptism.
Yeah, baptism. What are you anointed with in baptism?
Water.
water. And that's a ceremony as well, right? A ritual. So anointed carries a lot more weight than a more common word like smear or rub. Okay, anointed is something special. I think that's true why the Apostle John used that word anointed. He anointed the man's eyes with the clay, the word is clay there again, and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Pool of Siloam, little field trip. You ready for a field trip,
yes.
Bob?
Yes.
All right.
Got
all of our Bobs.
Got my permission slip.
All right, good. So, here we go. Can you guys see that? Whoops.
No. There's nothing to show here.
Nothing to show here. Okay, let me call it back up. I must have bumped something. There we go. Okay, this is a map of Jerusalem at the time of Jesus. And so partly I'm doing this to show you where the Pool of Siloam is, but also just as a little bit of a field trip or a side trip. Just to kind of remind you in case, or teach you in case you didn't know, the original city of Bethlehem, or the city of Jerusalem, the city of David, was right here. This is the old part of Jerusalem. That's the part that David conquered. It's on a ridge, Kidron Valley here, the Tyropean Valley or Central Valley right here, and it was highly defensible. That's why it was founded there. It was easy to defend. They put a wall on three sides, and you know, you didn't have ammunition like we do today. It was either swords or bows and arrows. And so you could defend yourself. The only way on into here was from the ridge along the north. So you just had to defend that one spot. And Jerusalem did withstand many attacks. As Jerusalem grew, King Solomon built the temple up here on what was Mount Moriah, because it was thought that was where Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac, which is a foreshadowing of God the Father sacrificing God the Son. So Solomon built the temple here. And then the city grew over onto this upper ridge. This ridge is higher. This ridge is lower. There's a valley in between them. Why did the ancients in the time of David and prior build the city originally on this ridge? Because there's a spring here called the Gihon Spring. And Hezekiah built a tunnel underground connecting from that spring into the Pool of Siloam right there on the southern end of the original city of Bethlehem. Can you see it?
Mm-hmm.
So, if they were under attack, they had a constant source of water. That's a big deal. Okay? Makes your city very defensible. You can hole up in there for a long time. So there's the Pool of Siloam. So, the mention of the Pool of Siloam shows us that Jesus is still in the area, and it's also referencing this location in the old city of Jerusalem. Now, just to kind of continue a little bit of this thinking here, this is Jerusalem at the time of Jesus. So, the city had grown from the time of David to the time of Jesus, and this is an upper city and another quarter that's all surrounded with walls. In fact, this valley down here was also filled in. It was where the more poor people would be, because richer people, the more well-to-do, would be on the higher place. That's where King Herod's palace is, over there, which is still, the ruins of that are still there today. So the poorer people would live down here, and some archaeologists claim that there was a wall at the time across here, so that this would have been old Jerusalem at the time of Jesus. You know, this area down here in the Tyropean Valley would be what today we would call the sand rabbits, right? I've heard that term from back a while ago here. So, why is it that the more well-to-do would gravitate to the higher locations?
They do today,
yeah. Right?
Well, no, today they
want to
be on the water.
Well, yeah, right. They want to be down there, right.
Yeah.
So, just to kind of finish this little tour, here's the Kidron Valley, there's Gethsemane and the Mount of Olives. There's the Pool of Bethesda. Remember that Jesus already did a miracle there in the Gospel of John. And that was a pool right outside the sheep gate. So that's where they would wash the animals for sacrifice before they took them into the temple to be sacrificed. So that's where that is. And there's the Antonio Fortress. So the Romans built that right on the corner so they could keep an eye over things. Yes, they weren't supposed to be allowed in the temple, but if there were riots, they would storm the temple anyway, regardless of the Jewish sensibilities. The old city today, if you're there today, I know a few of you have been. Whoops, I'm bumping something.
Your sleeve of your shirt.
Yeah, I guess my sleeve did. The old city today is this, you can see this faded line right here, and it comes down and across like this. So the old city today partially encapsulates what was the original city at the time of Jesus. This down here is just archaeological dig and ruins today, although it was there at the time of Jesus. And then this part is included, what was thought to be Golgotha and the Pool of Bethesda, which there's St. Anne's Church there now. That's all included in Old Jerusalem today. Okay? So a little bit of a field trip. Any questions?
Where actually is the new city?
The modern city of Jerusalem is all over here.
Ah, okay.
So if you saw one of my pictures of the Temple Mount, we were sitting up here on the Mount of Olives. I took a picture looking across the Kidron Valley, and in the background you can see high rises.
Okay, so the
Modern city of Jerusalem is all over here.
Okay, and the dome was where? On the top of the
Yes. Right there. During the Middle Ages, when the Muslims took over the whole region, the temple had been destroyed by the Romans already, so they're not responsible for destroying the temple, they, the Muslims. But they considered this to be a holy place as well, so they built a mosque right there, right on the same spot, which of course just ticks off the Jews completely. So they're at odds with each other. All right, there's another hand up. Yeah, Linda?
They didn't want to really include the blind man in what they were going after Jesus for, because he would have been wrong in taking that trip going and coming. The blind man, right? Because if it was a Sabbath day, you said, they weren't supposed to walk on it.
Well, you could walk so far. The Pharisees had established rules as to how far you can walk.
Right.
So we don't know where in Jerusalem Jesus met the blind man. He might have been, say, in here somewhere, so close by. We don't know. Yeah, you're right. If the blind man, if Jesus was doing this up here, that would be considered too far to walk on the Sabbath, but we don't really know. Yeah, good question. Okay, other comments or questions? By the way, there's this, by the time of Jesus, there were more pools than just the Pool of Siloam. Up until the time of Jesus, that's where everyone got their fresh water. So you'd go there and dip your jars in, wherever you lived in the city, that's where you got your water from. Then they added that pool, and that pool, the Tower Pool, the Serpent's Pool, the Pool of Israel, so you had four sources of water. Then the Romans came in, when they conquered the whole area, and they built an aqueduct. That's one of the technological advancements the Romans were known for, was building aqueducts and roads. So infrastructure came from the Romans. Yeah, Bob?
Well, the blind got this anointment on his eyes. And he had to walk to the Siloam pool. He had to be guided at that point to get to the pool?
Probably. Maybe somebody, some other local person, or maybe one of the disciples. Yeah, guided him. Yeah. Yep, you're right. Now, I looked it up because it says Pool of Siloam, which means sent. So I looked this up, and the Greek word there is Siloam. If you were to transliterate it, Siloam. Then I went to my Hebrew and looked it up. And the Hebrew word for sent is Shaloah. Almost the same. Not with an M on the end. Because the Hebrew word is a different word. The Hebrew word Shalom. You guys heard that word before.
Yes.
You know a few Greek and Hebrew words. What does Shalom mean?
Peace.
Peace. That's the Hebrew word for peace. That's not this word. This word is shaloah, which is translated into Greek as siloam, which does in fact mean sent. Now why is that important? John the Apostle includes that as a little parenthetical statement here. Why does that matter?
Because Jesus was sending the blind man?
Yes. Jesus is sending the blind man. What does he say up here? We must do the works of God of him, we must do the works of him who sent me. God the Father sent God the Son to do something. God the Son is now sending this blind man to do something. This blind man, it's not merely a matter of getting his sight back and being healed of his blindness. Because we're about to find out, especially for the rest of this class and the next time we meet, the blind man also witnesses about Jesus. That it's this Jesus of Nazareth who cured me. And it gets the blind man into all sorts of trouble with the Pharisees and the Jews. Okay? So, this is about being sent. Are you and I sent by Jesus?
Yes.
Yes! In your circumstances, in your personal life, in your vocation, and whatever, you also are sent by Jesus to witness to him. So there's a little bit of that going on here, too.
Being
yeah, Janet?
Being sent also means trust.
Sure.
That you trust the person who's giving you the direction to go.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Jeanine?
This time he didn't forgive the blind man's sins. But they talked about whose sin was it that caused him.
Yes! Very interesting, isn't it? Yeah, in other cases Jesus says your sins are forgiven. And oh, by the way, you're healed. Yes. In this case, he heals them, but he doesn't say anything about sins. That's a curious question. I don't have an answer for that. Yeah, why is it Jesus does certain things at certain times? I don't know. The mystery of Jesus.
Well, I'm amazed that you get mud put on your clay, this clay's put on your eyes, and you're told to go and wash it off. And I got to wonder what the blind man was thinking.
Yeah, no doubt.
What is this guy doing?
Yeah, right? What is this all about? And did he know that the clay was made from spit? Now, back then, it was probably less gross than it is today. Today, I'm like, ew.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, Jeannie?
And if that was their fresh water supply, don't get water from
yeah, the that's a good, you know, we don't think about that, too. This guy is dipping his face into the water. That's what we drink.
Yeah, you're right. That's our drinking water.
Yeah. All right, let's go on, or I'm not going to finish in time. Verse 8, the neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar, see there he is, as a beggar, were saying, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? Some said, it is he. Others said, no, but he is like him. He kept saying, I am the man. So, first of all, you see this beggar, and you say, hey, he looks familiar. Isn't he the guy who used to sit over there and beg? Yeah, but he's different. His eyes are open. He's got a different countenance about him, a different attitude. Wouldn't you be more joyful? And, I mean, your attitude would be different. Yeah, is it him or not? The neighbors, so the locals, they're debating. Is this that guy or not? He kept saying, someone last night pointed out, kept saying. He said it over and over again. Yes, it's me. Yes, it's me. Yes, it's me. Actually, he doesn't say, yes, it's me. This is not the right translation. He says, ego, I, me. He says, I am. This is a big deal. Dr. Weinrich, I didn't realize this, Dr. Weinrich in the commentary says, this is the only place in all of Scripture where someone other than Jesus uses the phrase, ego, I, me. It's the only place. Now, what does that mean? There's a Lutheran question for you. What does that mean? Why does the blind man say, I am, ego, I, me? That's the Greek version of Yahweh, the name Yahweh.
That here. Jesus sent him?
Yes, I think that's on the right track. Jesus sent him. So back to creation. There's a little kind of undertone of creation here. Jesus using clay to restore the man's eyes. In the original creation, mankind was given a job to do. What was our job?
Take care of the earth.
Take care of the earth. Have dominion over creation. Caretakers for God's creation. Which means that we, humanity, were intended to be God's representatives to creation. Okay? So, this man is Jesus' representative to the crowds and the Pharisees who are about to start interrogating him. Jesus isn't in this story till the very end. He's at the beginning when he heals him, and he's at the very end. And the big middle chunk is interaction between the blind man and the Pharisees who are challenging him that, no, you know, we're about to get into just the beginning of that. So this blind man is sent from God, sent from Jesus, really, more specifically. So he is Jesus' representative to others. Are you the representation of God to any unbelievers around you?
Yes.
Yes, you are. So in a certain sense, you represent God. I represent God to you in a public sense in church. You represent God to your family and those around you. God intends that. So we are ambassadors, all of us. He is an ambassador. That's why he says, I am. More profound than you think. Okay? All right. Moving on. So they said to him, then how have your eyes been opened? You're the guy, the beggar over there? Now you can see? How were your eyes opened? He answered, the man called Jesus made mud, and that word there is clay, made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and recovered my sight. They said to him, where is he? He said, I don't know. He gives an answer that's just a plain statement. So his very first witness is just a plain statement of what he knows. You are to be representatives of God to those around you. What do you say to those around you? And some of you might recall this if you remember going to this evangelism Bible study. Everyone his witness. What do you say to those around you?
What God has done in your life.
Yeah, you just say what God, what you know. This is what God did for me. I know I'm a sinner, but Jesus died for me because he loves me. That's a start. That's the basic minimum. And everybody knows that. You just say what you know. He just said what he knows. Now here's the curious thing. How does he refer to Jesus?
Man.
The man.
The man, Paul.
The man. He says Jesus is the man. He's about to, you're about to see, we're going to just touch on the beginning of it this class yet before the next time. His elevation or understanding of who Jesus is gets better and better and higher and higher. While at the same time, the Pharisees' understanding of Jesus drops. Okay? There's this change in perspective.
Like a Cairo.
So he, yeah, like a Cairo, sure. So he calls Jesus the man. Well, there's more to this. The man. This in Greek is ha anthropos. Ha, the. Anthropos, man. Think of anthropology. It's the Greek word for man. It's the exact same phrase that Pontius Pilate uses in this gospel when he brings Jesus out after being flogged. He says, behold,
the man.
Same thing. Is the Apostle John making a connection between this and what Pontius Pilate says? Yeah. Pontius Pilate sees Jesus as only a man. The blind man here sees Jesus, at this point, as only a man. But he's going to start seeing Jesus in a more elevated way very soon. Now further, there's more connection to this. Because there's some undertones of creation in this, right? With the use of the clay and healing and the blind man being I am, being the representative of God, that kind of has some hints at creation. Well, if we go back and look at creation story, anybody know what the name Adam means?
Man.
The man. The man, absolutely. So I'm going to the end of chapter 3 because it's fairly obvious right here. In Hebrew, the name for man is, the word for man is Adam. Huh. The word for mother is Eve. Huh. Interesting. So right here in the Genesis, this would be the man. It would be Adam. Call his wife's name mother. Oh, mother. Mom, Paw Kettle, right? So when Paw Kettle would say to Ma, hey, Ma, Well, it comes all the way back to here, right? The man, Adam, called his wife's name Eve, or mother. That's how you would read it in Hebrew, mother, because she was the mother of all the living. Was she?
Yes.
Yes, except for Adam. And the Lord God made for the man, you could say that's the man, and for his wife, garments of skins and clothed them. So why do the translators translate this as a proper name instead of the word mother, and this is a proper name instead of the word man or Adam? Why do they do that? Yeah?
Did God name Adam, but Adam named Eve?
That's a good question. Yeah, I kind of think so. I never really thought about it. Yeah, because all along in the first three chapters of Genesis, God calls Adam the man, Adam. And so that kind of became his name. His name is the man. How'd you like to have the name man? Hey, man. Yeah, what do you want? That's what it is. Well, here's the thing. Adam, translated into Greek, is anthropos. And what does St. Paul tell us, especially in Romans? Adam was the first man, the first human. He was the epitome of God's image. He lost that image. He became corrupted. Jesus, Paul says, is the second Adam, the perfect man, the perfect human, to use, you know, kind of the more general. And so Jesus is the replacement for Adam in the perfection of God's creation. Does that make sense?
Yes.
All of that weight right here is carried forward to John chapter 9, what we were just looking at. I'm going to go back there now. John chapter 9. The man called Jesus. So Jesus is the replacement for Adam. All right? Now, here it's not as obvious, but when Pilate comes forward and says, "Behold the man," Pilate doesn't know what he's saying. He's just saying, he's just a man. But in reality, what he's saying, this is the replacement for humanity. This is the second Adam. That's what Pilate is unknowingly saying when he says that. We'll get to there eventually.
In all 2 weeks.
So the blind man says, "Where is he?" "I don't know. He hasn't even seen Jesus yet, has he?" He doesn't know what Jesus looks like. He might recognize his voice, but he doesn't know what he looks like. All right, we're going to get through this last paragraph in 10 minutes.
Okay.
Stop giggling. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Who brought? The neighbors. The neighbors brought him to the Pharisees. At this point, in my head, I'm thinking this. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
You neighbors, you're arguing over whether I'm the beggar who's been healed. I told you I am. And now you take me to the authorities. What are they going to do? They're going to start interrogating me.
Yeah.
Sit me down in the dark room with the bright light in my face. You know, that kind of thing.
Deer in the headlight look.
Yeah, the deer. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now, it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay, that word is clay, and opened his eyes. So see, there we go. There's the problem, that it's a Sabbath day, and you're not supposed to do work on the Sabbath day. So the Pharisees asked him how he had received his sight, and he said to them, "He put clay on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such things?" And there was division among them. So the Pharisees are disputing between themselves. He can't be from God because he's breaking the Sabbath rules. Well, actually, he's breaking their Sabbath rules,
their Sabbath rules,
God's Sabbath rules. And others say, "Well, he can't be a sinner. You're implying he's a sinner because look at him, he's doing miracles. How can a sinner do such signs?" There's the word signs, not miracles. Okay? Now, we do know some of the Pharisees did come to believe in Jesus. We've already met one, right?
Nicodemus.
And we know of another, Joseph of Arimathea. So, not all of the Pharisees were against Jesus, but a majority of them were. So they're debating among themselves. So verse 17, so they said again to the blind man, what do you say about him since he has opened your eyes? Now this is the third time the blind man has been interrogated, and it's going to be a couple more yet. So he's like, how many times do I have to tell you? It's the same story, I'm not changing my testimony.
Oy vey.
Yeah, oy vey, exactly. And notice what he says.
He's a prophet.
Oh, he starts out by calling Jesus the man. That has a lot more weight than he realizes. Now he's calling Jesus a prophet. Guess where the next, there's two more steps coming.
Priesthood.
Guess where he ends up with calling Jesus, Messiah, Savior. Yeah, he gets there. His understanding of Jesus' identity is becoming more and more elevated. More high understanding. Okay. So the Pharisees are debating. Now remember what the Pharisees do. What are the Pharisees?
Teachers of the law.
Teachers of God's law. They are the ones who run the synagogues. So that's where people throughout Israel, in each of their villages that was big enough to have a synagogue, there'd be a Pharisee there who would run the services. Yeah, in a certain sense, you could say they're precursors to pastors. Mm-hmm. If I'm a Pharisee.
No.
The Pharisees started out with a good purpose. Okay? They were very noble, and they were teaching God's people and leading the services in the synagogues on the Sabbath. That was very good. The problem is they started adding their own rules on top of God's law. That's the problem. Well, can pastors do that today? Yeah, that can happen too. Let it not happen to me, I hope. I pray, but yes. So anyway, the Pharisees are teachers of the law. So what disturbs them the most? That Jesus is doing this on the Sabbath day. Because that's the day you're supposed to not work. We have all these rules as to what is considered work and what's not work. And Jesus is breaking our rules and not obeying the Sabbath. That's where their focus is. So one more verse, and then that's where we'll pause. Verse 18. The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, is this your son? So now there's a switch to the Jews. In the Gospel of John, what does John mean when he refers to the Jews?
Pharisees.
Pharisees and?
Sadducees.
Sadducees and?
Scribes.
Scribes and the leaders, yes. So the secular leaders, king, etc., and his administrators and bureaucrats, plus the Sadducees. What was the Sadducees' job?
They took care of the temple.
Yes. That was the family of the priests. And the Levites, they took care of the temple. They were concerned with the sacrifices in the temple and the rituals of the temple, not the synagogues. And we know from elsewhere that the Pharisees and Sadducees often didn't get along. Occasionally they did, but often they did not get along. They had different views on things. So, the Pharisees take this blind man to the Jews. That's a bigger group. The Pharisees is a subset of the larger group of Jews, which includes Sadducees and scribes and other secular leaders. Okay. So now what are the Jews concerned with? They're less concerned with the fact that he did this on the Sabbath. Oh, that's those Pharisees' concern. They're concerned that this is an actual miracle. Because if this is a miracle, then this Jesus is claiming that he is God. And we can't have that. Because that will change the temple and the rituals and the sacrifices in the temple. So that's a different concern. So you notice a difference between Pharisees and Jews. Jews includes Pharisees, but the Jews is a bigger group. Okay? All right. That's how far I got last night. So abruptly, we stop. Questions? Comments?
You left us hanging.
Yeah, and for a couple of weeks too, right?
Cliffhanger.
Come back 3 weeks from now. Skip 2 weeks, then come back.
Oh my. As a cliffhanger.
A cliffhanger. Well, you can read the rest of the chapter. I know. You know, that is allowed.
That is allowed, yes.
Yeah, that's okay. You can read ahead. All right, any questions? Yeah, Sandy.
I know this is kind of silly, but... when he says they put that on his eyes, I'm thinking, is it the eyeball or on the eyelid?
Eyelid. On his eyelid. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think his eyes would have been closed and he rubbed it on his eyelids. So is it really the mud or the saliva that cured him?
No.
What cured him?
Jesus.
Jesus' word. That's what did it.
And touch.
And touch, sure. Jesus touched, right? All right. Other questions or comments? See, I told you it would be...
Good.
Not 1 hour. Just short of 1 hour, right? Okay. There was another hand that popped up. Yeah, Bob.
I'm just making an analogy. This man is trying to tell them that it was Jesus and he is the Lord, but Jesus has been trying to tell them this forever, and so now here's another witness of him being...
The Pharisees and the greater, larger group of the Jews have been arguing with Jesus throughout this gospel. Who are you? Why do you say that? You can't testify about yourself. And Jesus says, I am, a number of times already. They're arguing and debating. Here's a blind man who's been healed of his sight, hasn't even seen Jesus yet, and already believes.
Yeah.
Yes, there's a huge contrast there. And that's part of the point of this gospel. It's really wonderful.
In verse 10 where it says, I am the man, if you say it's just I am, and that should have been it, maybe he was telling him all along, this is Yahweh.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He kept saying, I am. Maybe he's referring to Jesus as that I am. Yeah. Right. Yeah, Janet?
Does it say it also brings to mind the thing about blessed are they who have not seen but yet believe.
Yeah. That and that's in this gospel as well.
Brings it.
Yeah. None of us have seen Jesus in person, in the flesh. And yet we believe. That's correct. So we are all blind. But our eyes have been opened by Christ, by the Holy Spirit.
We see the different things and the different pictures of him. I'm wondering if we're going to recognize what it's really...
Your mind will be opened so that you will recognize Jesus when you get to heaven.
Yep. I hope so.
And he won't look like that.
Yeah.
Jesus looked like a Jew. That looks like a European. Right?
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah.
Jesus, so it's funny, and I know in some circles we laugh at that image. And that image, actually, Pastor Q told me, some of you might know this, but this is a very famous portrait of Jesus. That was done by somebody back during World War II who donated thousands of copies of that image as the size of a credit card to give to soldiers as they were going overseas to World War II. To remind them about Jesus. Jesus is with them. So I don't know what Christian or what denomination came up with that, but it had a good intent. It was to remind the soldiers in World War II. Well, that's kind of an American Christianity that's kind of become the common picture of Jesus, but it's depicting Jesus as a white European. He would have been a Jew.
But African Americans, if you see their picture, he's black.
Well, Middle Eastern people, you know, they're kind of that middle shade of skin color, so you could say they look a little bit black, a little bit white, and that's true. Jesus kind of was that color of skin. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of people that say they're black and they don't look at that.
Yeah. Say that again?
Kamala.
Now, don't get politics in. What did you say?
Just calling them all in color.
Oh, yeah, I've seen the pictures. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. All right, let's rise and close in the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good day. And grab another donut or coffee cake.